So, well, welcome to my talk about impact dynamics, void collapse, and jet formation. And that's work that is being done in the Physics of Fluids group at the University of Twente in the Netherlands, which is headed by Detlef Lohse, and these are the people that are involved in this research. Well, impact dynamics, the reason why we do this kind of research is depicted in this cartoon by an artist of an asteroid impacting on a planet like Earth.
Why would you care?
Why would I care? Why would anyone care? And traces of these events are visible all over the solar system, at least as far as we know. Here you see the famous Barringer crater on Earth, which is a small one. It's only 1.2 kilometers in diameter. And here you see a somewhat bigger one, Tycho on the Moon, which has a diameter of 85 kilometers. And very notably in these larger craters, there are some additional structures like the central peak that you see here. Geophysicists have a model about how craters are formed, and it's basically, this is the physicist's view, basically a ball impacts on a layer of material on the planet crust. It creates a hole. The hole, some material is evaporated, the hole expands a little bit and it rebounces, and this leaves the crater that you have. Well, it would be pretty impossible to do the experiment on the same scale in the lab. So what we do is on a very much smaller scale. We take a container of about 15 by 15 by 50 centimeters and fill it with sand. There is a sintered plate at the bottom through which we can blow air through the system. So this way we get a very loose sand. We turn off the air and let it settle into a very loose packing, and we measure solid fractions of only 41%, which is very low. If we now do the following experiment, we take a ball, we hold it, we position it on top, and let it drop, then you see the following. It's a bit fast. So there it comes. There's an enormous jet coming out of the sand. And if you look at the position of the ball at the release point and compare it to the maximum height that the jet reaches, then you see that typically the jet is higher than the point where you release it. So you get a lot of energy focused in this system. You can have a better look if you take a high-speed camera and image the jet formation with that. This is at 1,000 frames per second. You see this beautiful splash coming out. There's the jet. It falls back. Note clustering that takes place into the jet. And in the end, there is a kind of a granular eruption. So summarizing, we see three events. First, the impact creates a splash. Then a jet comes out. And finally, there is a granular eruption.
Well, is that eruption separate from the return of the material from the jet? What if you were to somehow, again, if you think of the planetary equivalent of this, that jet presumably isn't returning. What if you separate those two? I don't know how.
It's possible. Well, I'll talk about the eruption at the end. And we saw that it's an air effect. So basically, in a planet where you have an atmosphere of nothing, at least nothing as compared to what we have in the lab, then this eruption at the end would not be present. That's my idea.
OK, but you think it's independent of the return of the material?
Yes, and I will show you later. So why do we think that our small-scale experiments can say anything about these very large events that take place on planets? Well, let's look at two dimensional numbers. The Froude number, which is the ratio of inertial forces and gravity, and the inverse Newton number, which is the ratio of the inertial forces and the strength of the planetary crust. Well, if we look at small planetary impacts, they would be there somewhere on our diagram. and the large planetary impacts of BGA. Now, geophysicists do very spectacular experiments in which they shoot bullets at a target with a kilometer per second or so. And if we would put those experiments in this diagram, they would be here. But our experiments in this very soft sand and at very low impact velocities, typically a meter per second, they are somewhere here, so they coincide with the large planetary impacts.
So how do you measure the shear modulus of loose sand?
This is only an estimate. It could be shifted much more up or much more down. But well, the idea is that the inverse Newton number is so large here that the strength of the planetary crust or the sand in our experiments is not really important.
The planetary crust is consolidated sand, right?
Yes.
Sorry, did you say that air is still going when the experiments are
No, sorry. We turn off the air completely and really let it settle into this. No, it's a good point. Okay, the large planetary impacts, such as, for instance, Tycho, which I've shown you, but also the Chicxulub crater, which is to be found in Yucatan, Mexico, and which is held responsible for the extinction of, for instance, the dinosaurs. A 170-kilometer diameter crater. Good. The question that we ask physically is, what is the mechanism behind the production of this jet? And we take two approaches to say something about that. The first is to explore the analogy to an object which falls into water, and the second are 2D sand experiments. To start with the first. I'll show you a movie of a droplet impacting on a liquid. And many of you may have seen it before. See the void which is created here, a jet that comes out, and also note this little bubble which is entrapped and trained in the liquid. And it's, by the way, this bubble which causes the underwater sound of rain. The mechanism that we see here is that the void is formed. The void collapses subsequently due to the hydrostatic pressure in the liquid. A jet is formed at a singularity point, and air is entrained. To study this in greater detail, we devised the following experiment. We have a plunger, which is connected to a linear motor at the bottom, such that we can pull a disc through the surface of the liquid at any desired and very controlled speed. And here is the device in the lab. And we image with a high-speed camera. So this is a typical movie that you get with the high-speed camera. You see the splash, the void which is created, the collapse, and two jets are formed, one up and one downward. And it's nice to play it a little bit longer because you see that the jet falls back into the liquid, creates a secondary void, which also collapses again and creates another jet and another jet downward. So can we explain this from hydrodynamic theories? Well, one of the things we did was a boundary integral simulation. This is a simulation which is based on potential theory, so it's has as a prerequisite that you have an implicit liquid and that there is no vorticity present. And if you run this simulation under the same conditions as the experiment, then you see that the void is, of course, created just as in the experiment. The splash that you see is less resolved because of the limited number of nodes that we have in this area. But for the rest, it looks pretty similar.
Is this two dimensional?
This is a radially symmetric.
Wait, this is fluid in the bottom, what's above?
Above is, I think in this experiment, there's no air, so there's simply nothing above.
Like it. But there are any experiments?
There is air. If we do a one-to-one comparison between the boundary integral simulation and the experiment, we get the following. Of course, the pictures are from the experiment. And the red and blue lines are from the boundary integral simulation. And you see that it agrees very well only at the end we see a little bit deviation, and this is presumably because of the effect of air. I have to stress that there are no fit parameters whatsoever in this comparison, so neither in space or in time. So it's really a very good comparison. If we want to quantize this a little bit more, we look at the depth at which the void closes and record the radius of the void as a function of time. So here we have time until the collapse of the void, and in the beginning, this has not reached the position where it will collapse. Then the disk comes by, the void expands, and finally it collapses. And if we look at this in a doubly logarithmic plot, then we see that the final stage until the collapse of the void follows the power law with an exponent which is close to 0.5. And to that I will come back somewhat later in this talk. And this is a creature that employs what I've shown you in the experiment, actually in nature. There's not an experiment we can think of that isn't present in nature already. And that's the Basiliscus basiliscus. And this has very large paws, this lizard. And with these paws, it creates voids at the surface of the liquid. And why does the animal do that? Well, it becomes clear if you look at this movie, it actually uses it to walk over the water. So it really has to be fast, because otherwise the void will close onto its paw, and then the poor creature will sink, because I think it's not able to swim. And this is also why it gets its nickname, Jesus Christ Lizard. And here you see, it's pretty fast in the real time. Back to granular material, so the second point of the second way we look at how the jet is formed, and this is by performing quasi-2D experiments in sand. So what we have is two plates which are spaced about 2.5 centimeters from each other, and we drop a cylinder in them. And here you see this looked at from a 45-45 angle, and if you look closely you see that the motion is really more or less 2D. The jet that comes out is also has the form of a sheet rather than the shape, well, than the line shape it has in the 3D experiment. Here you see this from the side. You can see that indeed a void is created. The void collapses. Two jets are created, one upward and one downward, and air is entrained below. So we have the same mechanism in this 2D sand as we have in the fluid. The void which collapses due to the hydrostatic pressure in the sand. A jet, which is now a sheet and therefore less vigorous than in the full three-dimensional case, which forms a singularity where the two walls touch, and air is entrained below. And it is this air which slowly moves up through the sand and creates the granular eruption that you see at the end of the whole series of events.
Can you do this in vacuum?
That's a good question. Actually, Heinrich Jäger already did it in vacuum. And he didn't see the granular eruption at the end. But we wanted to do it too. He was simply faster. We also did particle simulations, and this was also because of that we wanted to put out the air. This is a simulation code which has both particles in it, but also the interstitial air. And we could turn the air off at will. The preparation is, by the way, exactly the same as in the experiment. Only the particle to intruder ratio is somewhat bigger. This has 400,000 particles. We could go up to 1.5 million, but not higher. And also because of this lower intruder to particle ratio, the jet is less impressive, but you see that the series of events creating the void is exactly the same, and also the closure of the void. By the way, from this simulation we found that there was not much influence of the air. The experiments of Heinrich Jäger, they saw that there was a big influence of air in the sense that the jet that came out in vacuum was not so vigorous as the one that came out with air in our experiments. We also did a little bit of theory on this, and we came up with the following model. First, we have a drag law through which the trajectory of the ball into the sand is described. And this gives us a trajectory. We can invert this trajectory to find the time at which the disk passes at a certain, or the ball passes at a certain depth z. And after that, after the ball passes a certain point, the cavity will start to collapse under the influence of the hydrostatic pressure.
It's like the drag law again, and then in an inviscid flow, there's no drag. It's only a body force due to the reaction of the acceleration of the flow.
Okay, but this is in sand, by the way, but this could be any kind of force that stops the ball from moving at a certain point in time. But this is intended to be in sand, not in in the liquid.
So this has a different form from that in an inviscid flow?
Sure, yeah.
And what is that form?
I'll come to that later to certain. So, and the void, when once created, will start to implode under the influence of the pressure in the sand. And we here take the hydrostatic pressure that is present in sand, and we expect that that's the only thing that we have. Fortunately, the Rayleigh-Janssen law that says that the pressure would separate at a certain depth, but that's well below the depths that we reach. To describe the implosion of the void, we look at a hydrodynamic problem. Namely, we have in 2D, we look in a slice, and then look how a circle in this slice would implode. And this we do by writing down Euler's equation in cylindrical coordinates, and add to that the continuity equation and the boundary conditions at the surroundings of the void. And if we integrate the Euler equation, we come up with an ordinary differential equation which describes the collapse of this void. And it's a Rayleigh-type equation because it's very similar to the 3D Rayleigh equation which describes the collapse of a bubble in a liquid. Now, we put all those things together. We have the time at which the ball reaches a certain time z. We have an equation for the collapse of the void as soon as it has passed this point. And they are linked by boundary conditions, namely that the radius of the void at the moment that the ball passes is exactly equal to the radius of the ball, and its velocity is zero. And from that, we then find the time evolution of the cavity profile. And I made an animation of that. And it looks like this. You see the ball falling in, the implosion of the void. It looks pretty similar to what we see in the experiment. So also, we can look at the large time limit, so very close to the collapse of this Rayleigh-type equation. Then this logarithmic term blows up, and those two terms are essentially negligible. Oops. Then we get the following simple equation, which, as a solution, gives us a dependence on time with a power 1/2. And then I want to remind you that this corresponds very well with the slope of 0.5 that we found in the liquid experiment. Finally, the characterization of the sand bed. We asked ourselves the question, does the sand bed support any weight? So what we did was do a second experiment in which we took a ping pong ball, positioned it on top of the layer of sand, and the ping pong ball was hollow such that we could fill it with an arbitrary amount of bronze particles. Then if we release it, this is what you will see. The ball goes in. It goes in up to 5 particle diameters deep, and the jet comes out like we've seen in the impact experiments. So if you would encounter this material in nature, then it would be like sinking 5 diameters deep, would be like sinking in quicksand, but then we do not have a dry, wet version of quicksand, but a dry version, and it would be just as dangerous. What we did was recording the experiments that we did with this system was recording the trajectory of the ball as a function of time, and the way we did it was to attach a rod to the ball and then follow the rod with a high-speed camera and thus deduct the trajectory of the ball. So here you see how that goes. And then we end up with a trajectory like this. So at t is 0, it starts out with 0 velocity, then it accelerates somewhat, and finally it decelerates and comes to a standstill, somewhat deeper in the sand. We thought about a model that could describe this, and the simplest model that we could come up with was Coulomb friction. And Coulomb friction, if you look at it in such a sand, you have, of course, the normal force, which increases linearly with the depth at which you are, and such that you end up with a friction law, which is linearly proportional to the depth that you are with, are at. So you can write down the following force balance to end up with this equation, which of course looks very familiar to everybody here, because it's a simple harmonic oscillator, of which we all know the solution. And omega is here the square root of kappa over m. And of course, the solution is only valid for the time, for half period, because after that, the friction force will simply turn around and not be valid anymore. Moreover, we find that the final depth that we reach is proportional to the mass of the ball. And if we compare the experiment with the model, then we see a very good agreement. Here for kappa is 13.5 newton per meter. And also, if we look at the final depth the ball reaches as a function of its mass, then we retrieve the linear relation, which is which comes out of the model. And the slope that we get from this linear line is in good agreement with what we found from the time trajectories of the system. Well, this was what I wanted to tell you. In conclusion, we have a jet formation process with a series of events which are similar in liquid and sand. A void is formed, which subsequently collapses due to the hydrostatic pressure. Two jets are formed, one going upward, one going downward, and there is a bubble entrained below the point where the two faces meet. Our prepared sand bed, the very lean sand, cannot support weight, and objects sink in many diameters deep. And finally, regards the impact cratering, jets are likely to play a key role in large-scale planetary impacts. And just to give you a few things which are different. First of all, the jet that comes out could explain the central mount that you found in impact craters. Secondly, it could be that interplanetary material transport, which is usually attributed to ejecta sheets coming out during the splash, could just as well come from the jet coming out from such an event. And thirdly, geologists and geophysicists also found in large impact craters a reversal of geological layers, which can never be explained by such a scenario, but would be very logical, a very logical consequence of a scenario like this. So thank you for your attention.
Do you have the ability to change the preparation of the sand, so it's intermediate, not fully
that's,
see as it is?
That's a very good question. We're actually working on that right now, but we have not come up with a way of getting really homogeneous system yet. But that's what we're working on by tapping and things like that.
Were the jet experiments done on the prepared sand or not?
Sorry?
The jet experiments.
Yeah, they were done on the prepared sand.
So yeah. Everything was on it?
Yes.
That you described as
yes.
Done in that equation.
Thank you. I asked jet labs this, and I never really get a satisfactory answer. But liquid jets are unstable because of surface tension.
Mm-hmm.
Your jet is unstable, but you have no surface tension. Do you
Correct.
Understand the mechanism of that instability?
We're working on that. We are actually performing simulations in which we only have particle-particle interactions, and there we see also clustering, like a one-dimensional freely cooling random
mechanism. Yeah, irreversible particle-particle interactions or
irreversible, so inelastic particle-particle. Yes, but we are not sure to. We are working on that to find out whether it's really that causes the clustering in the jet that you see, or that there might be. You could also think of air interacting with single particles, interact in a different way, of course, than air interacting with a cluster of particles.
You haven't done this in a vacuum.
No, we haven't done this in a vacuum. In principle, we can, yeah, and I know that Heinrich Jäger has done that, but I'm not sure about whether he sees clustering. So, but that would be, of course, a key experiment to really.
Is there any evidence of what the pattern's like in astrophysical
equations?
Or is it just a guess that initial
pattern?
Because you're obviously seeing very
clustering. Yes, well, the idea is, of course, in an astrophysical situation, you have a planetary crust which is much stronger, but the impactor is much bigger and has a much larger velocity as well as in our experiment. So in order for doing experiments which are comparable to the planetary case, we have to go to a very fluffy layer.
In the dimension is not
yes, such a thing.
Is there any evidence for bubbles under craters on Earth?
No, not that I know of. But it would be nice to
I'm trying to understand the what makes the ball stop.
Yes.
So if you just hold it still at above the sand, you let it go, it falls down several diameters.
Yes.
Presumably, I'm trying to understand how much of that is an inertial effect,
mm-hmm.
and how much of it is really just granular static. So suppose I could do the experiment where I held the ball submerged and let it go.
Yeah.
Would it still fall in the same way? Or
it, well, it,
why
it's,
doesn't it go all the way to the bottom?
I think I understand what you mean. Well, why it doesn't go all the way to the bottom is you could think of several things. What we think is, of course, is that it's a frictional effect. So you have friction, which dissipates energy at a certain point in time. The friction is so large that the work done by the friction is so large that there is no motion left. That's the way we see it. You could think of other things, of course, like it being the layer of sand below the ball being compactified, for instance. But this we checked that it isn't the case by varying the height of our bed. Of course, if you put a stick into sand, then you can put it arbitrarily deep, and it will simply stick. It will not, by buoyancy or so, there are no buoys in forests in sand, at least not in the sand that we use. If you would fluidize it, then it would be. And it's also nice to see that once we turn on the air again, then our ball falls through to the bottom of the container.
The fluidization effect there, so once you dissipate that energy, then
yeah.
Once you dissipate, I mean, it's not like a liquid which has an intrinsic temperature.
But dissipate what? Kinetic
energy.
So suppose I just held the ball just barely submerged in the sand, so it's top of level with the surface. Do you think it would fall?
Yes, well, it does. We checked that. Actually, we did the second series of experiments I showed you, the dry quicksand experiments. We did both with the ball really on top of the layer and half submerged. So But the way that we prepare the sand in the second way is by fluidizing from below with the ball in position, because otherwise you couldn't reach the layer.
Right.
But this also, this already caused so much effect in the sand that we would get results which were different from the ones that we would get if we position the ball after fluidization. But that's an effect of the airstream having to go past the ball and simply creating structure into the sand that isn't present if you don't have the ball. Do you understand a bit more? Maybe we should talk about it later.
I think, how far are you able to probe, I guess maybe, are you able to probe how the density of sand has returned after the impact? How is it all done? What's the density of sand and what's its distribution of space?
Yes. Well, the spatial distribution we couldn't look at. That's difficult, of course. You can hardly look into the sand. But what we do see is that the sand is compactified because the sand level goes down with about 4 to 5%. So it's more compactified after the experiment than before. And this is what you would expect, of course, because of the harsh collision, the collapse of the layer.
Yeah, I'm just wondering how far it propagates into.
Yeah. That would be interesting to look at. Yeah.
Another question, so let's thank our speaker again.